win over that person quickly and then try to respond to, in some way, to what this person was presenting. And that's how the hotline actually worked. And there were frequently follow-up calls, and sometimes persons would accept referrals, but more often than not, they did not.
But Rabbi, that puts a lot of, I'm not sure, I mean, there are other things that the rabbis do rather than just sitting on, how is the logistics of this, you know, to be able to receive those calls?
People could call collect, and they were instructed to simply say, this is a hotline call. People here at the temple knew that if something came over the phone and said, this is a hotline call, that I was to be interrupted no matter where, you know, as long as I was in the building. And if I was not in the building, then of course they would not accept it. They'd simply say, call back. And the same at home. So that I was on call constantly mm-hmm. with respect to this. And the reason for the collect call was to protect the caller, supposing it's a spouse who's calling. In this way, the confidentiality could be protected, etc. So that's how it worked.
Also children,
yes.
There must have been other people to receive the call.
He said there was a network.
All right,
no, all the calls came to
that's
me.
That's what I'm asking. Every call from the nation?
That's right. They could call from anywhere in the country, and they called me.
And you were the only?
I was it. Now, I mean, if I could refer, if they were willing to be referred to a rabbi in the area, then I did it. But what I'm saying is that the vast majority of them did not want to be referred. I mean, it's hard enough to pick up the phone in the first place.
Yes.
And then to call, and then to speak to someone else was too much.
But what was the network then? What was the network that you mentioned?
The network was in place, but it was rarely used.
I see.
Because they did not want to be referred.
Now, again, that seems like such a burden. If the call were to come in and you were not in the building or you were not home, and obviously not always, was it customary that they would call back? I mean, you were saying it was sometimes a life and death
situation. Yeah, I mean, this is something that there was no way of knowing. But if a call came in, generally speaking, there would be a return call. Or in some instances, rare instances, a number would be left. And I would call back.
And this is not in place anymore?
Oh, yes, it is in place. Yes, I retired from it and someone else has taken it over. I did it for 17 years. And Rabbi Prostowski is the new hotline person for the Reformed Rabbi.
Does he also have your kind of background?
He's a family therapist.
I see. Good.
You're saying that this is just for the Reformed rabbinate. Does the Conservative and Orthodox have something similar?
Conservative rabbinate did set up a hotline because...
Very recently.
Quite recently, because the person who was in charge of it called me and we spent a lot of time talking about how it worked and how... And so forth. So I know that they have something in place, but it's very recent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We were the first. The Reformed rabbinate was the first. And in fact, as far as we know, there were... In Christian circles, there was no such thing. We were the only ones that had that particular center.
This Rabbi Glaser, may rest in peace, did he have a background of psychology or social work? No. It was just an idea because he knew of the fellow who committed suicide.
He was the executive vice president of the CCAR. We knew each other, Rabbi Glaser and I knew each other, and he knew my background. So what happened was that when the suicide occurred, then he became very concerned. How can we meet this? What can we do with it? And so then it went through some committee discussions, and then he called and asked.
I see. Okay.
Most people don't think of that, you know?
Yes.
They don't.
Lebanon is a hard job for a Jewish young man.
Do you think harder than for clergy in
a
Christian
world? No, I think all clergy are in that position.
You obviously were involved in many things. What kind of time did you spend at the VA hospital, or what were your duties there?
I went to the VA hospital. I started in 1962, and I retired in 1990. And what I did was I would spend a morning, one day a week. I was there for 4 hours every week to take care of the Jewish patients at the VA. But I was also involved in a clinical training for our clergy, because the department offered clinical pastoral education, and I was involved with that to some extent, obviously on a limited basis because I was there only one day a week. So I had two functions. I served the Jewish personnel, and I also helped with that program. The particular facility that I served was a neuropsychiatric hospital.
When you say you were involved with the clergy, was it in a teaching position?
Yes.
Was this which VA facility was it?
This was Highland Drive.
Oh, yeah.
And you were also the president of the Greater Pittsburgh Brooklyn Fellowship?
Yes.
Would you like to say any comment on that?
Well, I was just, you know, I did my stint for for whatever the period was, and there was a bit of excitement, I guess, when I was when I was president, because it was during my administration that Rabbi Meir Kahana came to Pittsburgh and was going to wanted to speak at a synagogue. And
didn't he? I thought he did. One of my children
went
to listen to it.
Well, he didn't speak at the synagogue he had hoped to speak at, mm-hmm. because there were some moves made in which we successfully blocked that. So it wasn't the major synagogue that he spoke at. So there was a bit of excitement with regard to that. But that's the rest of it was pretty matter of fact. In terms of
what year were you president?
I don't remember. It's on,
you know?
It's
good.
On that sheet. Mm-hmm.
You seem reluctant to name the synagogue that he did.
No, I
nah, okay. I know where he was accepted. Yeah. Understandably.
And you were also a part of the clergy advisory for the Fort Smith Hospital?
Yes, yes. When the hospital was first established, they wanted Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish presence in terms of clergy. So an advisory committee was set up in the very early days of the hospital, and we worked out with the hospital what the role of the clergy would be in terms of hospital, not just hospital visitation, but also helping in a kind of team approach. It was the precursor to the kind of thing that now you have very much in place in hospitals, where they didn't have an ethics committee, but there were ethical questions that were being discussed and with regard to patient care and things of that sort. So it was an interesting time because these things were just coming online. And so it was pleasant to serve there.
What type of ethical questions, just generally, what are some of the things that would come up in terms of patient care?
Well, such matters as the, you know, turning the machine on, turning the machine off in case of life, you know, when people are on life support systems and things of that sort. We're just the beginnings of that kind of mm-hmm. discussion.
You certainly were a front runner in many things.
Well, I think every age has its excitement and things that are happening, and having been in Monroeville for a long period of time, I guess if you're in any place long enough, things happen around you.
Were there any questions that came up at Forbes in terms of Jewish patients who might prefer, for example, to have only kosher meals?
Oh, sure.
Or something? That's what I wondered. Did you work on that?
Oh, surely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Made, for example, a hospital had no provision for persons who needed kosher meals, and we set that up. We worked it out with them, and things like holidays.
Yeah, that's a service.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you did that.
Yes, we worked mm-hmm. it out with them, yes.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi, when it comes to ethics of should you remove the plaque or not, or maybe even donors, and I'm not sure I'm asking, is there a difference in what the Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative movements
yes.
think, and how did that affect your advising of what's going on in the hospital?
I think with respect to what we would call active euthanasia, that is, actually killing someone, I don't think that there are differences within the various branches of Judaism. I think we're all pretty much agreed on what the fundamentals are. And I always saw my position with regard to the hospital as speaking for the Jewish community, not speaking as a Reform rabbi.
That means when you say speak for the Jewish community, what would you say that meant? That whatever the others would want, or for example, an Orthodox individual?
Sure. Absolutely. Responding to the needs of the Jews who were in that hospital at that particular time.
This is a question I should have asked earlier, but why do you believe that the Reform movement has moved more to the traditional?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, I think Reform had as its platform the Americanization of Jews. Well, Americanization of Jews has taken place. We've gone as far as is sensible with regard to Americanization. There is now a need for Jews to develop an American Judaism which affirms Jewish tradition, which affirms Jewish values and so forth. You cannot have American Jews who simply mirror secular values and do that under the aegis of a movement that proclaims itself to be religious, proclaims itself to be Judaism. I don't believe you can do that. So I think the Reform movement had to begin to change because it had gone too far in the other direction. I think a second factor, and not insignificant, is that many Eastern European Jews have filtered into, that is speaking about Jews of origin, Jews whose origins were Eastern European. I mean, I'm Eastern European. And these people came into the Reform movement, which also brought more tradition into the form. And lastly, I think the whole optimism of the 19th century, when Reform first came into being, was a reflection of the optimism of a culture that believed that human beings would solve all problems, that mankind had within its grasp the solution of everything, that science would do this and so forth. And we've now come to sober up and to recognize that human beings don't have all the answers. Human beings don't understand everything. And certainly human beings cannot look to creating their own messianic time. Hitler taught us that. So all of these factors, I think, have been pinched on Hitler.
Not sure I understand that last part, the optimistic feeling that we could do it. Are you saying without religion?
Well, that human beings are the center of everything. There was that feeling all through the, certainly in the 19th century and in the early 20th century. We had that feeling that human beings would, you know, we'd put an end to disease. We'd do this, we'd do that. We would, you know, the space program is an example of that. We were going to do all kinds of things. We did extraordinary things, but the idea of making a god out of technology and a god out of science and a god out of people's goodwill, all of those things, what we did was we left no room for God. We just pushed God aside and I think reform went along with that. And reform never said no to anything. I think reform now recognizes you have to say no sometimes, and then there are ethical questions that also come into the picture. You can't say yes to everything, including ethical questions. Reform was very much involved with social action, right, working for the poor and so forth. But there's also the question of maybe Jews are too materialistic. Maybe individuals in their own personal lives want too much, are too greedy, and so forth. Those are ethical questions, and those are questions that Judaism speaks to. And Reform said nothing about those kinds of things. I'm not sure it's saying them now, but I think it has
some
to eventually.
Some are.
Yeah.
I see. Now I understand better. But they had to relate. Reform had to decide to relate to issues.
To Jewish
just
issues.
Not just say, hey, this is where we're going and that's it.
I think the tendency was to do anything that seemed to be the American thing to do,
mm-hmm.
and then to put a hechsher on it, to say, this is kosher within Reform. That is, this is what Reform Judaism stands for. I don't think you can do that anymore. We're finished with that. That's over. I would say that I myself never particularly liked the label Reform Rabbi. I'm a rabbi.
Okay.
And yes, I'm a liberal rabbi, and my training was in Reform, so forth, but to me, what's important is Jewish people, Judaism, God. These are things that are important. And that's without label, without whether it's Orthodox or conservative. We're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have different orientations, but I think we have to get away from the labels. Mm-hmm. They've been injurious to us.
Have you talked to some Orthodox rabbis about that recently?
Well, it depends. There's some you can talk to and some you can't talk to. But the same is true of Reform.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There are some Reform rabbis who, you know, they love that label, Reform, 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 mm-hmm. and they want to make, you know, they want to do everything like that. I mean, there were certain things that Reform did that I'm not in favor of. Mm-hmm. I was not so keen on patrilineal descent, that we ignore the rest of the Jewish people in its particular position, which is matrilineal, that it's based upon the mother, mm-hmm. that the child's identity is based upon the mother. We had a way of dealing with those children whose mothers were not Jewish and whose fathers were Jewish. We said if they were confirmed within our religious schools that would be okay. We did not have to come out and raise a big red flag to the Jewish community of America and say, we stand for patrilineal descent.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a big mistake in Reform, and I'm not the only Reform rabbi.
Oh, I know.
It drew an awful lot of anger online.
Terrible. Mm-hmm. Terrible. And that particularly affected our relationship with conservative Judaism, which was unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
didn't mean to do that. Anyway, I didn't mean to do it.
That's all right.
No, it's
okay. It makes it clear.
And now you're affiliated with St. Vincent College.
Yes, actually, I was teaching at St. Vincent prior to my retirement. I really had, you know, I was the rabbi of Temple David, and I did the VA thing, and I also taught at St. Vincent, and sometimes at Seton Hill, but mostly at St. Vincent. So I really have been teaching there 27 years. But when it came time to retire, I had a conversation with them and asked them if they would be interested in my expanding my teaching a little bit and coming on staff as a regular faculty member rather than as a lecturer, which is what I had been prior to this. And they knew me and I knew them, so it was a perfect situation. And they said yes, they would be interested in that. And so I, in the college, I went on to the faculty, regular faculty, and in the seminary, which was the new thing, I am now teaching in the seminary for the first time. So I teach a course in the college and a course in the seminary, which is very nice for me, interesting and stimulating. And God willing, I'll be able to do it for some years.
And what courses are you teaching?
Well, right now in the college, I'm teaching, of course, on Holocaust this semester. And in the seminary, I'm teaching a course on Torah. I'm teaching the Pentateuch, 5 books of Moses, to seminarians.
As a teacher, I'm going to ask you a question. I had attended a Catholic wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all Catholic, but it was a wedding. And the priest used the word mazel tov, but he didn't know what it was. Do priests and ministers, do they not normally get training in the Old Testament? They have to get training in the Old Testament. I mean, are they not aware, though, of what's going on in the Jewish religion? And are rabbis aware of what's going on in the Christian? Are you taught that in the normal course?
Bear in mind that this is a new development. We are talking about something that is still quite young, and that is that there's an extraordinary movement occurring in terms of Jewish scholars and Christian scholars jointly doing things on Bible and things of that sort. There are a lot of books coming out now for the first time since Vatican II, which was about 1965, more or less. So it's only in that period of time, the last few decades, that you've had the possibility of this kind of thing occurring. So my answer to the question is, now, yes, now, you're beginning to have Christian clergy approaching Bible, not through the lenses of the New Testament, but looking at the Hebrew Bible in its own right, and that's a new development.
And the Torah class that you're teaching now, is this the first time it's been
The first time it's been taught from a Jewish perspective.
I'm surprised. A lot of what you're saying today, I'm surprised. I just thought it was a natural progression.
Are you using only English? They don't have any Hebrew. Some seminarians have to learn.
Yeah, they have some Hebrew courses. I don't teach that, but they have some Hebrew courses. But in terms of an orientation to the text is of course being taught in English. Mm-hmm. But some of the students have had some Hebrew, and we look at Hebrew words here and there, and Hebrew phrases, and so forth. So. Mm-hmm. The answer is yes and no.
Mm-hmm. And your course on the Holocaust, is that a draw? And it's the basics? You know?
Well, I call it Holocaust Questions. And I have a particular philosophy with respect to teaching Holocaust, and that is that I believe that if you teach Holocaust directly, with an emphasis upon all the horrors, you end up with nothing. You paralyze people because nobody can look at bodies and so forth. You're just left without anything, vacant. So I call it Holocaust questions. And what we do is we look at the things that led up to the Holocaust. We, of course, do deal somewhat with the Holocaust, but then the major aim of the course is to look at our time and our culture through the prism of the Holocaust. That is, are there certain tendencies within our culture that were there and led to such things as the Holocaust, i.e., medical experiments? There are medical experiments still going on. I mean, that is, people are used in medical experiments. They don't know that they're being used. And that's still being done in the United States of America.
What do you mean they don't know they're being used?
Well, every now and again, there are exposés about the government having exposed people to radiation without their knowing that. That was done by the United States government. We tend to think that that kind of thing, well, that's what the Germans did, that's what the Nazis did. Or such things as industry exploiting people in different kinds of situations. Concealment, for example, of things that affect people's lives and health, such as the tobacco industries, all of that that's going on. Or the automobile industry that concealed the fact that they knew that certain models killed people. And those are kinds of trends that still exist in culture that were part of that which we associate with Holocaust kind of thinking. There are many things. Some are subtle, some are less subtle. So we try to look at the question of Western civilization against this terrible thing that occurred. That's the approach.
When you say Western civilization, you're saying, are we aware in our life today that these things could turn just as they turned in Germany? Is that what you
mean? Well, now, I don't know whether they go that far.
I don't know
far.
If they'll go, but it's a potential. That these are the kind
right.
of things
that's
that preceded
the
Holocaust.
That's right. Bureaucracies and various other kinds of organizational things that we have in place today have within them the inherent potential to be used destructively.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it actually goes beyond the skinhead or the parent?
Yes, it goes beyond that, right.
Tell me, do any of your students ever attend the Holocaust memorials?
Yes, they do.
Have they come?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This one.
Rabbi, would you like to mention some of the honors that have been bestowed upon you?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I don't know.
His wife married him. That was an honor.
I know you've been recipients of some awards.
Well,
maybe you should ask which he's most proud of.
Okay. Which of the awards
are you most proud of? It's really, I'm most proud of something that's a different kind of an award. Mm-hmm. And that is, I'm most proud of the fact that that six rabbis came out of Temple David. That's my greatest source of satisfaction in this sense, that it means in some way, somehow, that the teaching of Judaism that went on during the years here really had an impact on enough young people to cause them to want to carry on, to devote their lives to the Jewish people. And that's really my greatest.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from that, the fact that this congregation has a very strong holiday tradition that is unique in the community in this sense, that as a liberal congregation, I'm not speaking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I'm talking about Passover morning, I'm talking about Sukkot morning. I'm saying that you can come here on Passover morning and on Sukkot morning and find 200, 250 people attending a service. That is something that is unique to this congregation, and I must say is the envy of many of my Reformed colleagues. And thank God Rabbi Reins is carrying that tradition on. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that are the great awards to me for me.
Well, they are, because they're an indication of what you have given of yourself that somehow has been absorbed by these people, which is beautiful. It's the same as when you relate to your children and they carry on the traditions. You feel, I've given of myself.
That's right, that's right.
And this is the greatest reward.
Sure. And you never know. You don't know what's going
on. That's right.
You can't plan those things. Mm-hmm. You can only do to the best of your ability what God allows you to do, and the rest is not in your hands. Mm-hmm. So I consider that to be a blessing, that God has blessed those years.